in order, and then FedEx could enter into an agreement with the Secretary of the Treasury with respect to the foreign subsidiary, not with FedEx within the United States, but FedEx
Europe.
And Europe.
FedEx, absolutely. South America.
And so, and there's also FedEx did buy the Package Express company in the UK, and they also bought one in France. So this is extremely applicable to FedEx people. So the long and the short of it is, in order to participate in the Federal Insurance Contributions Act, FICA, they can enter to an agreement under the provisions of 31.3121L-1. And so this kind of focuses in on where Social Security is applicable. It lends total credibility to what Larry's been saying about these Social Security being treaty-based. Now, we don't want you running down the street with your hair on fire, you know, and try to make an argument out of this. This is like the building block to give you encouragement to go to the next step. And that, with that, I will turn it over to my very good friend, Sean.
Well, thank you, Gary. There's a couple of points I want to make. We came loaded for bear tonight, folks. In other words, we have much more material we were going to relate than we have time for, so I'm going to abbreviate what I was going to offer. But I want to point out a couple of things. First off, Larry's Universal Declaration of Rights. I've been watching this crazy show. Maybe some of you have seen it on Fox. It's the Mark Levin show. You guys watched that. He's pretty interesting. He has pretty interesting guests.
Sharp.
But yeah, he's real sharp. He brought up a couple of times over his shows the Declaration of Rights that Russia has set out for its citizens. And you know what? That Declaration of Human Rights, that Universal Declaration of Human Rights that Larry had at the beginning of the show, sounds an awful like a lot like the Russians' guarantees for their citizens. I wonder how it's working for them. It's not working for them well, but that's the promises that they make. What's in that Universal Declaration of Rights, a treaty or something that was signed? Nevertheless, doesn't sound like the United States Constitution. We don't make all these guarantees for our people. We knew better. And the next thing I want to hit on, and it's real important, and it goes to what Gary was talking about when he was showing you through one of the regulations, where he showed you several different times the United States used the word in those regulations, the secretary, whoever wrote them, the term citizen. When the government wants to talk about a citizen, they're not shy about using the word. When the government or the legislature sits down and legislates laws and they use terms like citizen, person, individuals, they don't all have the same meaning. It all depends upon the context in which they're being used, which was written into the law that they're talking about at the time. So you have to keep in mind, and this is why it's very important what Gary was talking about. The distinction between persons, citizens, and individuals is huge when it comes to reading what is being wrote to you by the government, whether it's by legislation or in any other matter, whether it's their manuals, whether it's by letter, it doesn't really matter. But what I'm going to do is show you a few illustrations about what we're talking about. I sent some documents over to Joe. Joe, would you pull up number 6? You got that up? Just yell at me.
It's on its way, hopefully.
There it is.
Okay, folks, now this is from the Social Security Administration, March 18th, 1998, to a fellow named Scott McDonald.
One of my friends.
Okay. Now, read closely what they're talking about here to answer his questions. They're saying this is a response to his letter. Social Security Act does not require a person to have a Social Security number to live and work in the United States. Did y'all know that? It says so right here. I'll take their word for it. Nor does it require a Social Security number simply for the purpose of having one. Well, that's good to know, too. However, if someone works without a Social Security number, we cannot properly credit the earnings for the work performed. Now, that's a real heartbreaker if you plan on claiming Social Security in the future or you want to get into their system. But when you take a look at the verbiage or the terms there, we're talking about person. It doesn't say citizen. This guy didn't write about a citizen of the United States. They're talking about a person. Other laws require people, doesn't say citizens, to have and use Social Security numbers for specific purposes. And they go on to talk about the tax laws and tax regulations. And they keep using persons, the word person, people. You never in here in this letter can you find in this response where they're referring to a citizen. Now, putting all this aside, if you want to interject, citizen, go ahead. You're contradicting what the Social Security Administration wrote if you choose to do so. If you expand the interpretation of the word person to include citizen, you have to remember what Larry told you, and that is tax statutes are what? They are examined in favor of and interpreted in favor of the people and against the government when there's any doubt or ambiguity. And when you have these distinctions between citizens, persons, and individuals, there's ambiguity. There is no question about it, and you'll see that as you go through the laws. Now, I was going to talk about banks and banking, how the banks say they need the Social Security numbers, and the Patriot Act requires that, and the bank secrecy, that's a real kicker, the Bank Secrecy Act. It's anything but secret, but that's what they call it. The Bank Secrecy Act requires you give Social Security numbers. This is not true. I don't have time to go through it now, but maybe we'll get it in another webinar as we go on with these. You'll find it interesting, especially if you've attempted to get a bank account set up without a Social Security number. All of their manuals, all of these bank manuals, even the manuals that they put out discussing the Patriot Act and the Bank Secrecy Act, they admit one thing for sure. They'd sure like that TIN, as Larry was saying, the term they use throughout these manuals and these publications and their explanations is, and even in the laws, they use the TIN, Taxpayer Identification Number. This is what they refer to over and over and over and over again. And as Larry's pointed out, and I'll point it out in a minute again, is the taxpayer identification number is meant for a non-resident alien, not a United States citizen. So let's quickly to number eight, Joe. Now, the IRS has told you, if you file returns, if you believe you're required to file returns, pay income taxes, that you have to have a Social Security number on your 1040 form, or they won't accept it. And they tell you under Section 26, Section 6723, if that's up in front of you, that if you fail to provide this information under a reporting requirement, particularly a Social Security number, if you fail to provide that information, you can be penalized a whole $50. I mean, that's what this is worth for them, up to, depending on a business and a person. Remember, a person is subject to this penalty. The even underlined person, this was taken right off of the internet. In the case of any person underlined, I wonder why they bring that to your attention, but every time they have person there, it's underlined. These are the persons, the people, I guess the entities, whatever they may be, that would be subject to this tax. If they meant citizens, the question arises is, why didn't they say citizen? Again, you can't read something into the statute which Congress hasn't specifically written into it. I'm not making that up. The United States Supreme Court has announced that principle a few times, have they not, Larry? Then we go on to the next regulation, and this would be under the 9.1 exhibit, Joe. And here they talk about identifying numbers. It's 301, regulation 301.6109-1, identifying numbers. And they talk about taxpayers. And they talk about individual taxpayers. And they talk about a Social Security number is included as an identifying number. It says there are several types of taxpayer identification numbers. That's TIN, T-I-N. That include the following: Social Security numbers, Internal Revenue Service, individual taxpayer identification numbers, IRS adoption taxpayer identification number, employee identification numbers. This is real interesting. So they use the term, as Larry said, just throw it out there. The term TIN means all of this. According to this regulation, you have to remember something about regulations. They can't exceed the scope of the statute. But anyway, they continue here and tell you about individual taxpayers. All through it, they talk about individuals, they talk about taxpayers. But you know that term that they keep missing over here over and over and over again is citizens. As you read through this regulation, you're going to find the use of the word taxpayer. You're going to find the word, the use of the word person and persons. As Gary and Larry just previously explained to you, taxpayers are, if you can swim the Rio Grande and you get over here, you may be a non-resident alien, but you're a taxpayer.
John, what document are you discussing right now?
We're talking about exhibit 9.1.
9.1, okay. Stand by a second, sorry. Okay, here we go.
Okay, very good. They go on here and they tell you what you where you would get a TIN number, why you would get one for a trust with multiple owners. There are tax for executor and estate. Goes on and on and on. Talks about all kinds of people, persons as payers, everything. But a U.S. person, what's a U.S. person by definition? That's a good question. If they meant citizen, seems to me citizens would have been in there, or citizen would have been in there. I can't find it. And again, it is told, or it is said, that when Congress chooses the word specifically for a statute, that's what they mean. That's exactly what they mean. They don't mean anything more. They don't mean anything less. Now, I think we've already been on that one. Let's see, where do I want to go from here? That's not where I want to go. There's one in here I'm looking for. It, folks, if you just bear with me for a minute there. Anyways, they go on to explain in these regulations. Oh, that's cool. Identification number and individual taxpayer identification number belong to non-resident aliens. This is on your number 9 exhibit, Joe. It's on page 12.
Okay, let me find that. Here we go.
Okay. As you go down through it, they talk about foreign persons. You start with page 11 at the bottom of it. You have employer identification number. An employee identification number is generally identified in records of database of the Internal Revenue Service as a number belonging to a U.S. person. However, the Internal Revenue Service establishes a different status for a number, the number either at the time of the application or subsequently by proving proof of U.S. or foreign status with the Internal Revenue Service. Individual taxpayers identification numbers is the next one on page 12, the triple three. An IRS individual taxpayer identification number is generally identified in the records of database of Internal Revenue Service, a number belonging to a non-resident alien. Now remember, when they say TIN, taxpayer identification number, they are by inclusion talking about Social Security numbers. They made that specifically clear. So the question becomes this is, why does anybody need a Social Security number? Well, the letter we first began with said you don't need one. And if you're not required to file returns, you wouldn't need one for that purpose. You wouldn't need it for tax purposes. You don't need a Social Security number for any reason whatsoever. But that's not what the real world is it? You go out, you get a bank account, the first thing they demand is a Social Security number. You go out, you try to rent an apartment, the first thing they want is your Social Security number. It's more important than your name. You get a credit card, they want that Social Security number. There's a misconception going around this country that you can't live in this country without a Social Security number. But if you go back to the Scott letter, it tells you right there. A Social Security number the Social Security Act does not require a person to have a Social Security number to live and work in the United States. Everybody who believes that, raise your hand. In reality, that's not how it works. But right now, my time is pretty much done. Next time we talk, we'll insert the rest of this presentation. We'll talk about banks and how to handle banks when you sit down and open an account, whether it's a checking account or a savings account, and they say, gee, you know, we need a taxpayer identification number and the law requires it. You'll find out in quick order that's not the case and the person at the bank has no clue what he's talking about. But we do have a question and answer period and I don't want to take time away from that, so I'm going to conclude with that.
Thank you, Sean. By the way, it's being shared is Sean's website, seanoconnor.org, or I believe Free Enterprise Society Services.org will work too if you are a good typist, but seanoconnor.org is the quick way to get to Sean's website. Yes, why don't we, let's see. I'm just scrolling down the chats. Mark said, it's my understanding that no treaty can supersede the authority granted to legislators via the Constitution. Thus, I believe no treaty can be enforced unless one voluntarily or ignorantly joins this private international arrangement. Comments?
Larry, that's yours.
I wonder if Larry, he keeps being muted, and so he could be talking, and let's try to unmute him and see what happens.
Yes, now.
Okay.
I had muted myself to cut down on the wavelength on this, so it wouldn't be as...
Yeah, those hamsters can only run so fast in Alabama. But anyway, comments, Larry? You
know, I think Mark needs to read the treaty memo I got posted over my website. You know, deals with, you know, starts off with everybody's favorite when they're talking about this particular issue, you know, the case involving the migratory birds. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff on that page, you know, where does all this control over radio, television, telecommunications, where does that come from at the federal level? They didn't have radio, telegraph, and telecommunications.
Treaty.
1790. You know, and there's a lot of those questions would be answered just by studying first that treaty memo, because then you will see that, you know, there's a lot of treaties. The subject matters of treaties is limitless. Treaties can deal with education. Well, if the United States enters into a treaty dealing with education in some respect, it's got these international obligations to perform regarding education. You know, it's going to help the state governments educate people. Oh, well, when you have those treaty obligations, boy, you need a Department of Education to deal with those treaty obligations and the treaties dealing with education. So you'll find that a lot of, you know, I maintain the FDA has a whole lot of treaty responsibilities. The DEA has a whole lot of treaty responsibilities. That's admitted. You know, there's just a whole lot of areas where Uncle Sam goes out and gets, you know, to me, if you look at Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, with all the carefully defined powers, but then you see some agency that is dealing with a matter that is not touched upon in Article 1, Section 8, well, I dare say that once you start doing your digging into the foundation for a particular agency, somewhere along the line, you're going to run into that old treaty. And Uncle Sam's entered into a whole lot of treaties. Hey, I mean that maintain that, you know, there's a real strong treaty connection with federal gun laws. So that's the way I answer the question, Joe. Read the brief.
Okay, very good. Peter commented, the distinction needs to be made between so-called positive rights versus negative rights. Any comments on that?
I have a difficult time understanding what negative rights are. What are negative rights?
Okay. Well, that's all he wrote. So,
okay.
Okay. Dan says, what the Constitution says doesn't really matter. The government does a lot that is unconstitutional. All it takes is a support of a mass majority of the people to violate the Constitution, and they'll have it. An international document with the perceived authority to declare entitlements as rights enabled citizens to believe they are entitled and can rightfully steal to get it. It's a war of ideologies.
Yeah, I want to weigh in on that. I couldn't disagree with Dan more. The Constitution does matter. These men sat down back in the 1780s, and they wrote this Constitution, and they wrote it to make a difference. They wrote it to make it matter. And yes, you are right. Oh, by the way, Dan, if you don't think the Constitution doesn't matter, you ought to go take a trip around the country and talk to some, or the world, take a look at some of these governments that said, gee, you know what, I think we're going to have a Constitution that we're going to fashion after the United States Constitution. Some people say, just send them ours. We're not using it. You know, that's they have a point to a certain degree there. But let's continue on. It does matter, point blank. So I'm not going to agree with that at all. The government does do a lot of unconstitutional things. That's why we have a Supreme Court. I understand the problems with the Supreme Court. I've read a lot of Supreme Court cases in my time over the last 33 years, and I'm sure Larry and Gary have read more than I have. But the bottom line is they're there to control those unconstitutional acts. Now, granted, the United States Supreme Court sometimes walk hand in hand, and they make unconstitutional decisions. And I'll tell you one that recently came out here when Obama was president was the Obamacare Act. When they sat there and said, they had this really, really great explanation for Obamacare and why it couldn't pass constitutional muster under the Commerce Clause. Finally, they got that one right. Let's hope that they go along with Thomas and revisit the Commerce Clause and get that thing back under control. But then Roberts goes on, this Chief Justice Roberts goes on to explain, but it's good under the taxation power because, you know, it's actually a penalty, but, you know, it's really not a penalty, even though the government says it's a penalty. It's a tax, even though they call it a penalty. So we're going to say it's constitutional under the taxing authority, even though it's a penalty. Now, when somebody figures that one out, let me know because I still haven't done it. So, yeah, we don't have a perfect world. The Constitution isn't a perfect document, but it's still the best in the world. It's still the best anywhere. And that's the only comparison that we have there. And as far as the majority of the people, listen, if the majority of this people were running this country and the rest of us were standing on the sidelines, President Trump wouldn't be in office today. Think about that. He didn't take the popular vote by something like 3 million votes, but there he sits, much to the chagrin of the Democrats. So, Dan, I think I would, you know, argue with yourself a little bit. I don't think it's all that bad. It's bad. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But if it is all this bad, and the Constitution really doesn't mean anything anymore, and the majority are going to rule and crush the minority, then you're talking about what Jefferson said, that the tree of liberty often has to be watered by the blood of patriots and politicians. That's what you're talking about. Maybe it's time. I don't know. I hope not. I hope we get this government back under control. But if you want to look at fault, everybody go look in the mirror quick. We let them do this.
Yeah, that's true. I do agree that the Constitution doesn't defend itself, and therefore, if we have the majority of Americans that don't know what a Constitution is, don't know what its purpose is, don't know how it's supposed to, you know, acknowledge our rights and be kind of a, you know, guardian of the rights that come from God, and you know, it is an uphill battle. If anything, it may not be that Constitution doesn't matter, but it certainly creates a much steeper hill for us who want to assert our constitutional rights, or should we say our inalienable rights that are acknowledged by the Constitution. It certainly is a much more uphill battle when most of our citizens that serve on juries, that vote for politicians, don't know what the heck it is.
Yeah, we're not Sisyphus. It's a hill, but we're not rolling a stone up the hill.
And by the way, juries are the last, I'm glad you mentioned jury, Joe, because they're the last bastion against the government. That's why the founding fathers insisted on a jury. When the government gets it wrong and they pass these unconstitutional laws and then they charge the citizens with violating the laws, the citizens sit there as a jury and say, I don't care what law you wrote. It doesn't fit within the scope of the Constitution or with what we want to live under. This guy was. That's what they did with Prohibition. Prohibition didn't work so well for him. He did it once. We can do it again. We can stop them in their dead tracks. You stop them in the courtroom, you stop them all over. You stop them dead. If they can't enforce these unconstitutional laws mean nothing.
True. All right, let's go on here. John says, does having an SSN and accepting the benefits of having an SSN subject you to an income tax?
My vote's no.
I would add that for John, once you pay into Social Security, and I believe it's 40 quarters, then they take the best 40 quarters and they calculate your Social Security benefits. That does not necessarily subject you to the income tax. And we don't want to get into the weeds or run off the page, but you know, the long and the short of it from my perspective is just merely having a social security number doesn't really mean a hill of beans in terms of whether you're subject to the income tax or not. Just like I pointed out in the 31.3121, and you can have a social security number, and that time, the only time that social security number really comes into play is when you're working for a wholly owned foreign subsidiary of a domestic corporation, which means the example I gave is like FedEx in France or FedEx in the UK. And you know, I remember seeing it a long time ago, and I wish I would have made a PDF out of it. On the homepage of the Social Security Administration, it used to say in bold letters at the top, you know, American citizens aren't required to have a social security number. And they've since taken that down.
And I'll just point out that sadly, because of how frequently the social security number is collected for every human pursuit under the sun, it certainly does create an easier way to surveil you and what you're up to. So the more that you can push back to these various companies, I mean, you know, getting a cell phone, there's all these different places that are asking for your social security number. And you might want to push back to the extent that you can. I heard recently of a person that bought a car, and they paid at a dealership, and they paid cash for the car, and the dealer wanted their social security number. And the person said, well, why would I need to give you that? I'm giving you cash. Oh, we need to check out your credit. And well, I'm not using credit. I'm paying you cash.
Currency so, transaction report.
Yeah, suspicious activity report. Yeah, you bet. That's
right. And of course, when I say cash, I guess I should say it was a check. You know, they were going to pay with a check, but you know, cash. They weren't going to finance or walk out without having the full price paid for the car. But it just goes to illustrate, or whether it be cell phones, cell phone plans, everybody wants your social security number, and there's hardly anybody that actually deserves it. So push back when you can. That's the only comment that I would make. Gary, Sean, or Larry, the next one from our good friend Joshua, who always joins us regarding 3401C. Want me to read it to you, or do you see that there on the chat?
Yeah, the 3401C definition of employee, you know, whenever they drift over to subtitle C, this is where they come up with their creative language and their definitions. And you make a really good point talking about non-resident aliens, and I believe you're absolutely correct. And I'll give you my theory of it in a little box limited to whether you're a non-resident alien or employee, and how it would interplay with Subtitle A and Subtitle C. We all know that Subtitle A is the income tax. That's Chapter 3 of the code identifies the people who are subject to the tax, as well as who's required to deduct and withhold the tax. We're looking at Section 1441, Section 1442, Section 1443, and 1461. 1441, and let me just emphasize these sections in one vein, and that would be Section 1441 is a non-resident alien individual. A non-resident alien individual is a living being, just like you and I. And so you have a non-resident alien. The next one is a foreign corporation. Foreign corporation is a person, but person means and includes a corporation, a partnership, a trust, in addition to an individual. But we know that a foreign corporation basically is a, you know, it's a person, but it's not a living being. It's living in the sense of its charter. But as far as it being, quote, an individual, it's not. Same goes for the Section 1443, Foreign Tax Exempt Organization. Foreign Tax Exempt Organization is a corporation, foreign corporation. So you have a living being, 1441. You have an artificial entity, 1442. You got an artificial entity, 1443. The only living being that could be an employee is foreigner, non-resident alien. You go to 3402 talking about withholding of income tax at the source. Now, we can get into it at a later time, but Yahshua mentions section 1441 at the bottom of his comment and his question. Is basically 1441 is the non-resident alien individual. You go over to the definition of withholding agent. Section 1441 is your non-resident alien, your living being. And my theory is, and I could discuss it at length by email or certainly at this venue here at a later date, but your 1441 character, in my view, is the only person that could actually be an employee under the subtitle C, dealing with withholding of income tax on wages and within the United States. So that's something we can talk about and make some notes about in the future.
Joe, Larry's muted again.
Oh, is he? Okay.
I think he was held up a sign.
Let's see if I can find all Larry. In the meantime, want to let everybody know that, okay, Larry should be unmuted. Want to let everybody know that we dropped the ball. I remember last week, or I'm now remembering, that last week we promised that we would preserve the chats from last week and address those questions. I did preserve the chat, but we completely forgot to address the questions. So that wasn't intentional. It just kind of popped into my mind, especially looking at the time that we've been on for, you know, about an hour and 20 minutes. So I apologize for that. I'm going to be making a note to resurrect that chat from last week to make sure that we honor our word.
Peter clarified negative rights, by the way.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary. You want to read that to everybody?
Negative rights are one that does not require someone to provide a good or services to you. Example given, the right to free speech, a positive right would be one that requires someone to provide something of, such as an example given, education.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, so we'll move on here from Luke. Oops. From Luke, Trump won the popular vote. The Democrats steal most of their wins.
That argument's never going to die.
That is a debate.
Star says, the IRS issued me an EIN for my sole proprietor business, even though I do not have employees. Is there something I should do about this?
You know, I find that interesting in a couple of different ways. First off, that a sole proprietor would have an EIN number, especially in the absence of employees, notwithstanding that it doesn't apply to you in the first place, as Gary and Larry have explained. So I find that peculiar in and of itself.
Well, is it possible Star can't, you know, basically it's whatever he or she put on there, but if somebody has a sole proprietorship and they fill out an SS4 and they put down the name of the sole proprietorship and they put down theirs or somebody's social security number and they send in that application, the IRS is going to happily issue them an EIN, right? I mean, if that's what they want, they're going to give them one.
That sounds about right. I'm not sure I'd do that, but it sounds about right.
I would never have.
I personally think people ought to look at the form to get a TI, to get an employer identification number.
Yeah, I agree.
What line is that, Larry?
As far as the bank account goes, Star, that's a whole another issue we're going to have to touch on next time we have a webinar. I have a lot of information on that. I think you'll be interested in. That's the bank's answer to everything. Oh, gee, we need an EIN. Oh, gee, we need an SSN. We need this. We need that. The banks need everything when it comes to these numbers for all the wrong reasons. And the fact is they're not required to ask for them. They're suggested. It's suggested they do, but there's no law that requires it. No law that requires the bank to have it.
Yeah, in fact, I guess I should have realized that she said the bank I have a business account with needed the number. So that must have been what precipitated Star applying for the number, was because the bank told her they needed one. And that is all too typical. Again, we're not promising that if you push back you know, it's going to work every time, because there are a lot of people out there that I think they'd literally take you by the neck if they could to extract a number out of you. But nevertheless, all we can do is try to promote the idea, the reality that these numbers are so infrequently necessary, and society has just gone crazy with collecting the numbers. So we're just trying to educate people about how infrequently they're required.
And Joe, that's a good reason for people like Star to push back when a bank demands it. Even if you end up giving it to them, push back and say, hey, you know what? I brought in a few pieces of paper here about these social security numbers in your bank and your policy, and guess what? I don't have to give one. You don't, and you can ask for it, but it doesn't mean it's required. Even if you end up capitulating, at least you're trying to educate somebody and you've dropped a seed in their mind.
Yeah, and I guess this might be a good time to point out that you know, we have four hosts who show up here every week, and I provide the contact information. So granted, none of us, or we all have things that we've done in our lives or had to do, and boy, if we had been able to talk to somebody ahead of time or do a little pre-planning, we'd be in a lot better shape. But nevertheless, remember that there's contact information for all four of us, and based on the issue that you think might be out there on the horizon and what the various hosts have presented to you in terms of their knowledge, and I would argue it's pretty broad, at least of the three guys other than me. but we, you know, give a contact, to give a shout out if there's issues that are coming up, you know, and maybe those are issues that can be tackled. So with that, we're getting near the end. Are you guys able to stay a few more minutes, or should we kind of wrap it up with maybe one more question?
There's a couple of more
questions. For however long y'all wanted to do it.
Okay. John is asking, can you pass the Robertson letter around? Maybe he means that letter from
Scott McDonald.
Oh, Scott McDonald letter? Send me an email address. I'll attach it to return a reply.
Okay, so seanoconnor.org, everyone. Get in touch with Sean via his website. And you can inquire more about that letter. All right, from David, I agree about the Social Security benefit having nothing to do with the IRS. The U.S., I guess he meant Constitution, guarantees each of us the right to contract for a benefit. Oh yeah, Constitution is what he meant. So it's more of a comment. Got one last one from Joshua. Can we as a group and a movement come collectively together to craft a bill to present to our elected officials to repeal the 16th Amendment on the grounds that it was not properly ratified from a legislative process?
Larry?
Well, in 1985, we started the battle over the ratification of the 16th Amendment as a result of Bill Benson's work. And, you know, the courts came to the conclusion, gee, it's a legislative problem. It's not a judicial problem. Take your problem there. And we did. We took the word of the courts and presented to Congress this matter of the non-revocation of the 16th Amendment that didn't do anything about it. You know, this deals with creating a movement to accomplish something. And I look around at the tax movement. You know, the tax movement's been subjected to a lot of fly-by-night artists that have passed through it. You know, gee, I've got something here that, you know, you can follow. Just send me $1,500 and boom, you'll be out of the tax system. There's been a lot of that. You know, the meaty stuff that needs to be done is something like that, you know, trying to pressure Congress to do something about it. I don't think Congress will do anything about it, but I also think that, you know, we spent a lot of time on the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment issue. I think that there are other matters that have a higher priority right now than the issue of the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment. I think educating the American people about how it really applies. You know, in my view, the 16th Amendment, you know, the only reason why we brought the 16th Amendment argument is because the court sits there and said, oh, we get our power from the 16th Amendment. Well, I disagree with that. You know, what the courts have really said, if you look at the Brewshaber case, you know, the 16th Amendment just simply says, hey, as Tommy used to say, the 16th Amendment applies to the 9 justices on the United States Supreme Court. The 16th Amendment simply states that all federal excise tax, all federal income taxes have to fall within the excise tax category. And that indeed is exactly what it does. And I think we need to focus in on who is subject to the income tax. And we'll, that might be a whole lot easier to get accomplished than, you know, what we tried to do to get Congress to do something about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment over the last, since 1985.
Yeah, how I heard that, Larry, is I know the Stahl case said this is a Congress problem, take it to them, it's non-judiciable. And then Congress, what I heard was Congress said, oh, no, this is an issue for the court. So they're playing, tennis?
Yes.
Ping pong.
Yeah, ping pong, too. And he goes on to ask, this can become a campaign issue. Hey, great. If you can get this to be a campaign issue, I'd love to hear them debate the 16th Amendment rather than free health care. Yeah.
Well, and I think we have to acknowledge that when, you know, Dan's overall message, we can kind of see maybe where he's going or means to go, and that, you know, we really have to police who we get into office and then who's appointed into these positions of judges. The ramifications of who's chosen for the judiciary can have, you know, decades of effect on us. So we have to work to awaken our fellow Americans. And I've actually got an acronym for everybody for tomorrow when you get together with your relatives. It's RPAR. RPAR, remember that. It's Red Pill a Relative. Okay. So we want you all, and you know, there's 30 or so people on the show. We want you to red pill a relative, at least one tomorrow, but you know, 5 or 10 wouldn't be bad. Red pill a relative about the show, about our collective websites, about anything that you feel comfortable discussing, because we really need to spread the word to our fellow Americans and let them understand what's gone on over especially the last 100 years with relation to the income tax, the monetary system, et cetera, et cetera. So, let's use this Independence Day to edge just a little closer to a little more independence. So we can have last comments from our hosts. Start with Gary.
Yeah, Mark brought up, he says, we still haven't addressed the Supreme Court statement he had sent about the 16th Amendment, wherein it says, from whatever source derived, does not mean from whatever source derived. When are we going to address that statement? I think it means whatever source derived, and there's only two sources.
You can go ahead and expand if you want, Gary.
The from whatever source derived really kind of falls under the heading of, you know, first off, I believe that the 16th Amendment applies only to foreigners, but that's open for debate. But from whatever source derived, there's either two sources, from sources within the United States and sources from without the United States.
Yep, I think Excuse me, Gary. Yeah, geographical. Absolutely. People overlook that. They're not talking necessarily about salaries and wages. It's geographical. Absolutely.
Right. And so, you know, when you're looking at source, you're not looking at, you know, someone working at 7-Eleven or somebody working for General Dynamics or some other corporation or whatever, Walmart. But it's talking about the source being from whatever within the United States or without the United States. And, you know, there's some case law on the 16th Amendment. You know, Bruce Haber with the Supreme Court says that, the 16th Amendment didn't give Congress any new power. You know, it's an excise tax. You know, is the excise tax apply to citizens? I don't believe it does. I hope I addressed it to your satisfaction, Mark.
Larry, you're unmuted.
Well, I agree with what Gary just said. Source, in my view, is geographical source. And there's two real sources. Look at the source rule, starting at section 861.
There you go.
Sources within the United States and sources without the United States. That's all the code deals with in reference to source.
How does that while we're on that topic, how do you juxtapose that though with, as I understand it, when they talk about from whatever source derived, that the income is derived from, like in the same manner that an apple is derived from an apple tree, the apple tree being the source, and the apple being the what's derived from it. Is there, you see where I'm going with that in terms of?
Yeah, I see what you're talking about. True, there have been courts talking about source in that fashion. But let's take a look at how Congress is, how deals, you know, you get this, let's say that Congress is getting a power from the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment uses the word source in it. Well, then let's look at how the power, whatever source might mean, how it's being implemented in the law. Well, when you go to and take a look at what source means in the law, you start off at the source rules, starting at section 861. You got 861, then you got, you know, if non-resident aliens and four corporations at 871 and 881. And then you go up to, there should be maybe a 902 or something in there, but you go over to 911 and, you know, now you're talking about sources outside the United States for citizens. So, you know, I think you got two great categories of sources already within the code. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Congress has done. It deals with source in the 16th Amendment inside that law. The 16th Amendment may grant some type of a power, really doesn't, but let's say that it does. Well, then how is Congress, you know, the 16th Amendment isn't imposing the tax. It's the federal laws that are imposing the tax. It's the federal laws that have to be construed. And when you take a look at the, where is source found in the tax laws, it's 861, sources within and without the states.
Yeah, you know, and you know, like
we're kind of stuck with that. You know, Congress has come along and said that there are two sources, within and without the United States.
Yeah.
Somebody want to expand it beyond that?
Well, you know, the Internal Revenue Code, too, talks about a couple of different things. As you were saying, Larry, I mean, you take the term United States, they'll redefine the United States in the Internal Revenue Code. For one section, it will mean all 50 states. For another section, it will mean the District of Columbia, the possessions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't find it particularly unusual that first, before you're looking at the activity that generates the income, which the IRS calls the source under Section 61, is far different than the source where you're starting to look with the activity from where that activity is generated from, which is geographical in nature. You have to look where that law applies before you can look to what's generating the income that's taxable.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone quite a long time. So I think that was probably appreciated as a little bonus discussion there relating to source as it's indicated in the 16th Amendment. Looks like Mark has a lot of court cases there, but we could go on forever. I'll save this chat as well. So at least make sure that the hosts look at Mark's final.
Well, Joe, may I make a final comment?
Mark? Sure, go ahead.
Mark, the from whatever source derived, as it's used in Evans versus Gore, and I haven't read that case in probably 12 years, but Gore was a lawyer or something, it seemed like to me. But what I'm saying from the standpoint of looking at from whatever source derived, it's if you just take it in context of asking one question, and remove all everything from the periphery, but so look at it from the standpoint of Congress shall have the power to tax incomes from whatever source derived. I have one question: where did Congress exercise that power? That's the big point.
Okay, very good.
And it's in the code, by the way.
Very good. Well, I think if anything, we show you that the only thing we won't do is argue till midnight or discuss till midnight, but our hosts are ready and willing to opine on your comments and we try to answer as many questions as we can. I think this has been a very fruitful show here on the day before Independence Day, 2019, and we really appreciate everybody joining us. I guess I didn't really give a chance to Sean or Larry to say any last words.
Just to sign off. Great 4th of July. Hope you all have a great time. As far as I'm concerned, next Christmas is the best holiday of the year.
Larry?
Happy Independence Day. Shoot off those fireworks.
You bet.
Very cool. So RPAR, everybody, Red Pill Relative, and we'll see y'all next week. Thanks for
Bye. Bye, y'all.
Bye.